So with Bitcoin, anyone with internet access can all of a sudden have freedom. You know, they can have the freedom to own property, to secure it themselves with math instead of with violence. And they can share that with anyone in the world instantly.
Welcome back to the 12th episode of the Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast. I am your host, Eric Rao. Today we have Alex Gladstein, who works with the Human Rights Foundation and is a Bitcoin humanitarian. He is also the author of many recognizable works in the Bitcoin ecosystem, including Uncovering the Hidden Costs of the Petrodollar, Fighting Monetary Colonialism with Open Source Code, and most recently, Bitcoin and the American Idea. On today's episode, we talk about each of those pieces, why Bitcoin stuck out to Alex as a humanitarian, how Bitcoin can help the unbanked, and many other topics. Thanks for joining once again, and I hope you enjoy the show. All right, welcome back to this episode of the Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast. Today, I'm proud to announce that we have an author, the Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation, and a Bitcoin humanitarian, Alex Gladstein, with us today. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Glad we got this worked out, and you know, it worked out well with your new piece that just came out. So if you don't mind, if you could give the listeners a little bit of background on who you are and what you do, that'd be wonderful.
Sure. So I work for the Human Rights Foundation, which is a nonprofit based in New York City, founded in 2005. I started working there in 2007. We were a bit of a kind of a nonprofit startup at the time. Now we're a pretty good sized organization that has programs around the world to help people achieve political freedom. And as part of that mission, we host events where we connect dissidents and human rights advocates together. We run legal programs where we help people, we help them get out of sort of prison or other kinds of repression that's sort of against the laws of their own countries and against international laws. We do a lot of programs with regard to getting education and technology into the hands of people who need it the most. And our work is focused on those who live under authoritarian regimes. So about 4.3 billion people around the world in around 95 countries, ranging from Russia to Saudi Arabia to China to Ethiopia to Cuba, that's where we would be focusing on. And in my time at HRF over that first decade, I learned a lot about how, you know, freedom is at risk around the world, and learned a lot about what the struggles are that people face under these kind of regimes and these political environments. And that helped prepare me for Bitcoin. To understand that this was a tool that was going to be hugely helpful for so many people. And for the last 5 years, that's what I've been looking at very carefully, is the intersection between political freedom and Bitcoin.
Very nice. So you've been in the Bitcoin world, you said, for about 5 years now.
Yeah.
What was your introduction to Bitcoin?
Well, before that, before I started looking at it closely, the first time I was introduced to it was in 2013. Some activists came to us and they wanted to see if they could use it to get money to Ukraine, which was about to go through a revolution, basically. And the following year, some of our donors at the Human Rights Foundation wanted to give us Bitcoin. They wanted to pay for some conference tickets that we, you know, we hosted this event, and they wanted to pay for their tickets in Bitcoin. So we're like, all right. So we started accepting donations in Bitcoin. 2014. And I had, you know, I had this loose understanding of it, but it was super surface level. And I didn't really dive in deeply until spring 2017. That's when I started looking at it really carefully. So all through 17, 18, 19, 20, and now 21, I've been looking at these connections between Bitcoin, the Bitcoin network, and how it can empower people around the world.
So what was the thing that finally made you dive in for yourself?
Yeah, so late 2016, early 2017, we were approached by some folks who wanted to come to our event series and put Bitcoin on the radar of human rights activists. So that got me thinking, all right, that's interesting. Maybe I should learn more about this thing. And I just went down the educational rabbit hole. I mean, just, you know, watched all of Andreas Antonopoulos' videos and looked a lot of the stuff that Jimmy Song was putting out and read what I could and started following folks on Twitter and, you know, got to sort of watch the scaling wars kind of come to a crazy end that year. And obviously saw the price bubble in the following bear market. But that's when I did the most, you know, of my development, I think, in terms of really understanding that potential here was in that bear market, right? So 2018, especially, like all I did was, and I still to this day, I'm learning every day, but like literally all I did that year was learn as much about Bitcoin as I could. So, you know, that's kind of how it came together for me.
That's awesome. So when you have a human rights background, what was it about Bitcoin that you really saw to have potential to help in the way that you pursue helping, you know, people in these 95 countries, these 4.3 billion people? What was it about Bitcoin that you saw the parallels?
Well, it was more that I saw people in these countries using Bitcoin. That I wasn't like, oh, Bitcoin, this could be cool. I was like, oh, wow, people are using Bitcoin in these countries. Maybe I should look at it more closely, right? That was kind of my thought process. And then that, and combined with a few other things I mentioned, forced me to go down the rabbit hole, learn about it. But at the end of the day, Bitcoin helps us achieve freedoms that politics fails to give us. I mean, that's a simple way of saying it. Like, politics is broken all around the world for a lot of different people. Whether you live under occupation by a foreign power, whether you live under a dictatorship, whether you are a disenfranchised class in a democracy even, or group of people, your politics is broken and you cannot like achieve what you want to achieve, and you cannot be free really through politics or through the ballot box. That's a huge failure of governance around the world for most people. Only a small percentage of people can reasonably say that they can sort of achieve their political freedom through the ballot box and through the society around them. The overwhelming majority of people on earth either don't even have that option at all, or, you know, even their democracy might be broken. So with Bitcoin, anyone with internet access can all of a sudden have freedom. You know, they can have the freedom to own property, to secure it themselves with math instead of with violence. And they can share that with anyone in the world instantly through the Lightning Network, and they can transmit value. And you're starting to understand now how over the coming years, it's going to be this great foundation for so many other things. For social media, for communications, we're already seeing that. For the relationship between creators and their audiences, you're already seeing that. But also for even these very advanced forms of finance, I think are going to start coming to Bitcoin in terms of, you know, the ability to have basically Bitcoin accounts that are pegged to some foreign currency, for example. Like, this is going to be made possible soon through post Taproot, through some upgrades to the Lightning Network. You'll basically be able to have like a Lightning balance that's like pegged to a particular currency. You'll be able to do a lot more with regard to contracts, loans. I mean, basically we're going to start to recreate all the functions of the financial system in Bitcoin over the coming 2, 3, 4, 5 years, all kind of in a trustless way, which is really mind-blowing when you start to think about it. All of these experiments that are run currently on DeFi today, all with like, you know, huge compromises when it comes to centralization and trust, those experiments are going to come to Bitcoin soon enough, and it's going to be pretty breathtaking to see what happens. But at the end of the day, I mean, most people simply are satisfied with learning how to use it for its just base case, just to be able to earn save and spend money the way that they want to without any government or corporation getting in the way, whether it's receiving an income or a donation or a remittance, being their own bank and securing that, and then deciding, you know, to spend that whenever they want, you know, at their discretion, in a way that doesn't get debased or confiscated or censored, is just massive. So I think you have this base use case of just like a better money, more simply, and then like all kinds of amazing stuff that people are going to build on top or are already building on top.
Yeah, it's definitely an exciting time with all the things that are being built and the jumps that are being made right now. Excuse me, right now. Can you touch on any specific stories that you've seen of the way Bitcoin can help, you know, those who are unbanked throughout the world, and what you've seen really to be able to empower them and really help change their quality of life?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's many. I actually have been, my next article is going to be about Palestine. And I've been talking to folks from Palestine, and it's really crazy. They just have such a difficult economic situation. It's so kind of controlled and centralized. And anytime they do something that the government doesn't permit, it's sort of like labeled as terrorism or suspicious or, you know, grounds for whatever. And, you know, the kind of foreign powers, the Israelis, et cetera, you know, they've really like done a number on the Palestinians' ability to like have arable land or control their own water. And it's just very difficult for them to have property over time. Like it gets confiscated violently from them. So talking to them about Bitcoin's digital property is kind of revolutionary. Like they can finally secure something that's theirs, that they earned with their time and effort, and they can use math to protect it. I think that's pretty amazing. So this one Palestinian woman I was talking to today, you know, she has family that still lives in Gaza, and it's extremely difficult to send money there. And she's been able to start introducing them. She's been able to get them to learn about Bitcoin, basically. So now she can just send them Bitcoin. She actually sends it to like a mutual friend type person, who then the family like picks up the cash from that person. But this is like so much easier than the previous way of doing it, where like she would have to go try to do a bank wire, which could take like many days or even weeks, or get frozen or get flagged as suspicious. I mean, anytime you're sending money to Gaza, it's like, okay, what are you doing? And then the other option was some sort of Western Union thing, and the fees are just so high. And again, it takes time, it's slow. So now she can just send money like instantly to someone who's just like, you know, in the community in Gaza. And then that person can just hand out cash to someone that she's connecting to. And eventually she'll be able to teach her whole family about how to actually secure the Bitcoin themselves. And then they'll just be able to do peer-to-peer transactions. And there's like a really lively peer-to-peer marketplace in Gaza, but both in Palestine more broadly with regard to like Paxful and local Bitcoins. If you just go, you can look at it right now. But also with regard to like Telegram, basically, like finding people on Telegram. So you've got a people who have long been economically downtrodden and kind of like trapped, basically. Like they're going to break their way out with Bitcoin. It's like the hammer. They're going to break the glass, grab the hammer and break out. It's just, that's like pretty amazing to think about. So I thought that was top of mind for me.
That's very cool. And it's cool that you're able to help tell those people's stories and help other people learn about what's truly going on. And I think that's gotta be a pretty unique experience. Have you had any experience similar in El Salvador with the work that Bitcoin Beach is doing and now President Bukele? I know you were on the Twitter spaces and kind of helped him get towards understanding volcano mining. So that was pretty funny to listen to. If you could tell us a little bit about what your opinion on El Salvador and what you think is going on down there, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, look, we all knew nation state and adoption was going to come to Bitcoin at some point. I mean, I believe that all nation states will eventually use Bitcoin, but it had to happen at some point. I'd say that this was surprising for a couple of reasons. A, that it happened as a legal tender law and not as a reserve asset at the central bank. I mean, I think a lot of us had been prepping for this kind of digital gold narrative, right? That Michael Saylor had been pushing, and corporations were starting to like buy a little bit of Bitcoin to balance out their, or a lot of Bitcoin to balance out their cash on their balance sheet, right? And to basically diversify their assets. But I don't think anybody was prepared for a government to adopt, well, except for people in the know, to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender, as harnessing its payment network properties. And that's amazing. And that just shows you that the digital gold narrative is incomplete. I mean, that's not why this government adopted it. I think it's remarkable for several reasons beyond that. I mean, this government's going to establish a large fund of Bitcoin. They're going to ostensibly airdrop $30 of Bitcoin to like millions of people. This will be the first large nation, to our knowledge, you know, first large nation state sort of accumulation of Bitcoin. As you mentioned, they're going to be unlocking stranded renewable energy at volcanoes, which could really bootstrap a lot of economic activity and also allow them to have more independence with financing. Like, if you had a choice, would you take the loan from the IMF or the World Bank, which comes with a lot of like, let's say, considerations and possibilities that if you screw up, they would come and like force you to kind of enforce like austerity measures in your country, structural reforms, right? You know, reduce subsidies and make your people more angry. I mean, this is what they come and do. Or would you choose to sell bonds based on future earnings from untapped renewable resources like volcanoes? So that's what they're going to be able to do. It's amazing because all these developing countries in Central America and on the western coast of South America all have incredibly untapped geothermal volcanic renewable energy that's just sitting there. It's like far away from population centers that they haven't figured out what to do with it. But you can mine Bitcoin with it. So I think that piece is really interesting. I think the fact that Bitcoin Beach sparks the whole thing as a grassroots community, this was not some sort of like central planner that came in and said, we're going to do Bitcoin. No, like it was like a grassroots thing that eventually caught the eye of a very opportunistic, young, kind of brash leader who is going against the grain here. And it's such a big milestone for financial freedom. I mean, you know, now you're seeing other countries think about it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's a major, major moment in time. Really interesting how it happened. I think what's that expression that there are, you know, days when months happen and months where nothing happens or something like that. Yeah, like in the span of a few weeks, we got like this really important Bitcoin upgrade locked in on Taproot, which is going to really improve all kinds of efficiencies and privacy issues for a lot of users and really expand what's possible. We got nation state adoption in El Salvador, which is huge. And then we got the decentralization of mining out of China, all kind of happening at the same time. So like when we look back 10, 20 years from now, this month or so is going to be a very, I mean, forget the price run up. I mean, these three things are more important long-term. So I've been looking at those for sure.
Yeah, that was a very interesting point that those three major things all happen pretty close together on the grand scheme of things and with how influential they will be. Within that, you touched on the volcano mining and how it unlocks geothermal energy, mm-hmm. and how they can actually like finance themselves with that. Mm-hmm. Can you dive in a little bit more into how that works for the listener? And I know you've mentioned a project in Africa before that I think is already, you know, doing this kind of thing. Would you just mind touching on that a little bit more?
Sure. Basically, in Virunga National Park in the Eastern Congo, outside investors had financed several dams for hydropower on the Congo River and its tributaries. But once the dams were built, they weren't able to connect the dams to the grid, to the population right away. It's expensive and capital intensive to do so, especially in a, you know, mountainous, rainforested, remote area. So, you know, these turbines for the, in these hydro plants just kind of were running, you know, inert for a while. And this is sort of what's called curtailed energy. It's like literally curtailed or wasted. And Bitcoin miners somehow, like, they started a conversation around this, and this park actually started mining Bitcoin about a year and a half ago, I think, with these dams, and really generating the revenue needed to build those transmission lines out from the grid, from the park to the dams, and really get everything going. And I thought that was really interesting. And that's going to start to happen across the developing world and across America too. In El Salvador, what's interesting is, like, you start seeing this idea of like a renewable energy bond. So, like, again, you can raise money from foreign investors with a promise to pay based on provable renewable energy source. Okay, so the risk is tied to the fact that there is renewable energy, like it's provable, it's measurable, etc. Before, you couldn't monetize it because it was, like, far away from the population, etc., etc. But now, you know, this country can basically say, hey, we want to raise $450 million to build out this world-class Bitcoin mining facility at this, like, 600 megawatt, like, you know, volcanic activity region. And again, whereas before they'd have to borrow that money from, like, you know, whether it's sort of short-term or long-term via the, like, the World Bank or IMF. And again, it would come with all these, like, restrictions and sign here, sign there, sign there. I mean, now they can, like, borrow off the back of the energy that's in the ground beneath their feet without needing to deal with the World Bank or the IMF. It can just be a bilateral deal between the government and whatever company or other government is interested in helping to finance this Bitcoin mining operations. I think that's pretty revolutionary. We're going to start seeing more of that. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. It's truly, truly interesting and beautiful in a way of how, like, the stranded energy is actually going to lead to Bitcoin being able to help these remote communities that haven't had, like, energy and, or I'm sorry, like, power throughout their communities yeah. before. It'll be truly cool to 100%. Watch. Yeah, it'd be truly cool to watch over the coming years. So you mentioned the waterfall in the Virunga National Park in your article about Bitcoin fighting monetary colonialism in Africa. And I believe it was in that article. Could you give us a brief overview of, like, what is monetary colonialism? And then we can kind of dive into it from there.
Sure. Well, monetary colonialism has been practiced in many forms around the world, including here in the United States. Of course, we just had July 4th. We're thinking about the way that the American colonies were restricted in various ways by our British overlords. The French designed a particularly nefarious version of monetary colonialism. After, you know, during World War II, they kind of still had the world's second largest sort of colonial empire, right? They had possessions in North Africa, Southeast Asia, South Africa, Central West Africa, the Pacific. I mean, really a breathtaking empire enforced by brutality, right? And a lot of those provinces or territories or possessions or however you want to call it started breaking away. So, you know, despite their best efforts, they lost Indochina, they lost Algeria, they lost a lot of these huge, very important geostrategic kind of territories as these nations became more independent. And they were, like, really committed to not losing their whole empire. So the year 1960 was very important in Africa because that was the time when it became, like, basically politically impossible to continue straightforward colonialism. So all the European powers agreed to leave this, you know, great scramble for Africa they had started. 80 years earlier, that they were going to leave the local people to rule themselves was the idea. What the French realized is that they could essentially have independence for their former colonies in name, but in reality, they could still control them through the money. And this was a very kind of imperial arrangement where basically you had about what is to this day about 15 of these nations, ranging from Senegal to Togo to Niger, Chad, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, et cetera, et cetera. They make up today about 180 million people in a territory the size of about two-thirds the size of India. So vast, vast territory. Three times as many people live in these colonies now, rather former colonies now, than do in France today. And the deal was such that France would be the central bank for these people, would issue their currency, would make their currency, all the banknotes and coins. It was called the CFA or the CFA franc. France would control the monetary policy. They would require that like all of the activity be routed through Parisian currency markets. They would require that any exports or earnings by each nation would have to be stored. At first, it was 100% stored in Paris. So like all the savings of each country had to be given up to the French. I mean, complete lack of financial independence for each country. I mean, it's really stunning. So a lot of leaders fought back and tried to leave the system. Some of them were assassinated straight up, like in Togo or Senegal. Some of them were overthrown kind of in a way where the French were like, they didn't get involved, even though they could have, like in Niger. And sometimes in one case, the French even like, they got pissed and they were like, fine, we'll leave, but we're going to ruin the country, you know, on our way out. So they basically like in Guinea, they dumped, like a huge amount of banknotes, into the country that were fake. They counterfeited a whole bunch of money, dumped it in and ruined the economy of that country and the future of that country on their way out. So this monetary colonialism is, you know, each kind of iteration of it's slightly different. As I was saying, you know, the Israelis kind of practice a similar type in the Palestinian territories today. Obviously, Britain in certain ways was kind of controlling the early American colonies in a similar way. There's many different iterations of this, but the French version is crazy because it's still to this day exists. The reserve requirement's been dropped to 50%, but everything else is pretty much the same. There are some reforms happening, but all sort of surface level stuff. They call it Africanization. Over time, basically, they moved the central banks to Africa instead of being in Paris, and they let some of the decision makers on the boards be Africans instead of Europeans. And, you know, they're even reducing some of the reserve requirements over time. But over, you know, at the end of the day, it's still a French controlled system. So, you know, the citizens of these countries, they don't have a lot of hope, you know, because their local leaders are dictators usually that have this deal with France. So like, it's hard for them to push for political reform. And the whole status quo like wants to keep the way things are, like they want to keep it that way. So Bitcoin's an interesting way out. You know, it's kind of like, as these people I interviewed said, it's like the decolonial currency. It's like the currency of true decolonial, you know, decolonization, because it's, you know, something that the foreign power doesn't control and something that the domestic power doesn't control. So they can start sort of opting into this new global system that's not, you know, they can't really be used against them. And it's very powerful because that currency system was really used basically by France to run, and still is to run. This is like their own private reserve, essentially. Like, again, they would get like cheaper than market prices for like strategic minerals and lumber and stuff like that and labor. And then they would get to then make that stuff in France, you know, into cars or you know, electronics or more advanced kind of finished goods, and then sell them back at a huge profit to the colonies who dug the stuff out of the ground. And you know, also culturally, this has been very tied with the French language and kind of just brainwashing all these people into believing that the French are there to help them, when in reality they're keeping them down, and the results have been catastrophic. I mean, I think like half of the 10 poorest countries in Africa are all in the CFA zone. 14 out of 15 have never seen any meaningful democratization. I mean, these are some of the poorest countries in the world. And you know, the French claim that, hey, you know, they get to use the CFA, so, you know, they don't see high inflation because it's pegged to the franc. Okay, well, first of all, between 48 and 99, really, you know, this 50 years, the French devalued the CFA 99.9%. Okay. So the last major event was in 94, but like basically over like the series of many, many events, like they devalued this currency. Used to be, I think, two CFA francs, two French francs per to a CFA franc. And then before it finally switched to the euro, it was something like 100 to 1 or something like that the other way. It's just insane. So it's just theft, you know, and there's a lot of other detail that I go into my essay. But the point is that like the situation is just not a lot of solutions. Like if we didn't have Bitcoin, I don't know what they would do. Like there's just not a lot of hope there. But Bitcoin's hope, and it gives individuals in these countries a way to opt out. And I think that it's the same in any place. In any place with internet access, like you can start to have some freedom, even if your government doesn't want you to have any. So I think that's the cool part.
It's sad when you start to hear about these stories, and you know, we never knew this stuff growing up. This isn't what we're taught in schools.
I mean, I didn't know about it like previous to a few months ago. So
truly sad. It's like heartbreaking to like start to read about and like listen to these stories, and you start to like realize how big of an effect the money has on an environment and on a nation. And hopefully, you know, as more nations will adopt Bitcoin, they can start to see, you know, maybe some of these nations in the CFA zone can start to see that, hey, there's a chance for us if we also make this adoption and start to head that direction as well. Have we seen any of the CFA nations starting to like look strongly into Bitcoin?
Well, no. So that's the thing. It's going to have to be grassroots, because the CFA nations, again, are ruled mainly by like strongmen and tyrants that are like in allegiance with the French. So they're not going to want people to have monetary independence. The whole point is that they're not monetarily independent. So it won't come top down like in El Salvador. El Salvador, you had a unique case of a country that was already dollarized, you know, didn't have monetary discretion already, was already sort of a U.S. ally. Or you know, full member of the IMF, World Bank, all that. And they just decided to kind of hedge their bets a little bit, but very different than the CFA system. So if anything, I think in a lot of these other parts of the world, if you're going to see Bitcoin adoption at the national level, it's going to come as a result of popular movements and just the general times changing. I highly doubt that some of these, you know, very unlikely that the CFA countries would decide to add Bitcoin in that way.
Makes sense. Hopefully we can start to see that grassroots adoption come sooner rather than later and help give these people a way out. Okay, so your most recent piece, you released this on the 4th of July, and it's called Bitcoin and the American Idea. Mm-hmm. Will you give the listener a little bit of background on that, and we can chat about it a little bit as well?
Sure. Well, I just saw the 4th coming up, and I've always thought of Bitcoin is very American in the core idea of what America was when the founding fathers, you know, decided to rebel against the British. I thought that, you know, I've always heard this FUD about how like, oh, you know, Bitcoin's not patriotic because it's going against the dollar or whatever. But, you know, like the Patriots in 76, you know, they were committing treason, you know, against the British to strike it out and make freedom politically here in America for at least some of Americans, right? So I think it's similar now. Like we have a restrictive system that people are going to break free through Bitcoin. And I just always thought that the values of Bitcoin in terms of how it kind of resonates with free speech and property rights and sovereignty and kind of open capital markets and personal freedoms is just couldn't be any more kind of linked when you read that Declaration of Independence. It's just there's so many similar vibes going on. So I wanted to do a piece on that and how kind of obviously in my view, at least of my reading of history, American history is very distant from the American idea. And there were many compromises made along the way, including at the very beginning, actually, that laid the groundwork for a very powerful kind of centralizing state that committed a lot of depredations of different kinds, whether it was against African Americans or Native Americans or countries around the world, foreign leaders, even our own people more recently. Basically it paved the way for kind of, again, a system that was quite centralized where an elite could make decisions on behalf of everybody else. And that's like kind of increasingly not American, I would say. And this is in line with the sort of petrodollar article that I wrote earlier this year. This system, the current dollar system was designed by Nixon and Kissinger. Like it was not like, I would not say that that's like patriotic to have to like follow that. So I wanted to talk to some people who had interesting perspectives on this idea of like America, the concept versus America, the execution. And also like how, what does Bitcoin do for us? Like, does it get us closer to that ideal, to that utopia? And I talked to an African-American, Native American activist who uses Bitcoin. He's a really remarkable guy. And then also a Iraqi refugee who came to America, loves America, and now is now an American citizen. And they're both Bitcoiners, but they have very different perspectives. And I just, it was such a pleasure to be able to talk to them and try to kind of weave this all together for people to think about on July 4th.
Yeah, I think you picked a perfect day to drop that one. And saw the writing on the wall there a few weeks in advance. So good work on that. So what did you see with, and correct me if I'm wrong, his name's Isaiah, right?
Isaiah and Faisal, yeah.
Isaiah and Faisal. So what did you hear from Isaiah when you were researching and, spending time with him to write this article about mm-hmm. his view being a Black and Native American man and the mm-hmm. idea, the American idea?
Yeah, well, for him, he even has issues with the American idea itself because he's like, it was their idea, obviously he's here for anti-authoritarianism and throwing out the British. Like he's here for that, right? But he's not for the fact that there was like no Black men or no women, certainly no Native Americans in that room where they made the Constitution. And he just feels like it's never really been his idea. It's always been someone else's idea, And what's so interesting is that with Bitcoin, he's been sort of a part of the story, right? He's been able to like help promote this idea of like, not your keys, not your coins. Like he calls it not your keys, not your cheese. And he's been helping promote January 3rd, which is the launch of the Bitcoin network as like the real Independence Day. And he just feels like he's part of that. This is more of his story. And like so much of America's history is stuff that either was like super, aggressive towards his ancestors, whether it be like the rounding up of Native Americans or enslavement of Blacks or Jim Crow South or whatever. And he's looking at this map of America and he's like, we were not involved in drawing any of this up. Like he feels more like a citizen of the world, I guess. And it's just cool that Bitcoin can like bring him there. Like, right. So, in Bitcoin, everybody's equal before the law. There's no like, just because you come from one state or another, have this particular color skin or this particular creed or belief or whatever, none of it matters. Like we're all the same citizens in front of Bitcoin. I just thought that was quite powerful. And just, it gave him some hope after just a lot of depressing early years where he just knew he was being lied to, especially about the Iraq war from his perspective, like in his community, they could have used a lot of support, right? And then we were off invading some other country and he didn't, and as a kid, he didn't know why, trillions of dollars for what, maybe for what? Well, maybe it was to protect the dollar, but at the time it was like, hard for him to understand. So I thought that was really, really interesting to speak to him on that day.
Most definitely. I will definitely have to reach out to him and see if I can get him on, hear his thoughts on it directly, because I did think his part was, you know, very, very powerful. And, you know, it's something that you and I don't have the history of growing up where we see it firsthand.
No. And I think what's also, I mean, also just his book, like there's parts of it that talk about the disenfranchisement of Blacks when it comes to the current financial system, like just in terms of banking or taking out a loan, or they're just constantly discriminated against in a systematic way. And he's like, basically he's like, fuck the banks, dude. This is basically what he says. And he's like, the banks have always held us down. Let's be our own bank. And I just think that's quite inspiring.
Definitely. His book is Bitcoin in Black America. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. I'll make sure to have that in the show notes as well. And then you've alluded to it twice, the petrodollar, and then, you know, talking about the Iraq war. I know we don't have a ton of time left, but if you could give us a touch on that a little bit about, you know, what is the petrodollar system and why it kind of hurts Americans in a few different ways.
Sure. So about 100 years ago, the British pound sterling was like the most powerful currency in the world. But after World War I, you know, the European powers were kind of in a state of disrepair, and a lot of the gold flowed to America. A lot of the loans were taken out by them. And we were like this creditor. So we became this like huge creditor nation. A lot of power and strength went to America. And so much so that as the decades passed and we actually went into another major world conflict, World War II, by the end of that conflict, all the allies met in New Hampshire to choose the new world monetary system. And America was just like so strong and powerful that we basically got to get our way. And what we wanted was that everybody to use our currency, to use dollars. And that's what happened. That's the Bretton Woods system. So everybody used dollars pegged to gold at 35 an ounce. But, you know, everybody used dollars around the world starting in, you know, in the late 40s, but really happening in the 50s through the 60s. And you know what, for a little while, we did a pretty good job of holding that system together. But after JFK was assassinated in the 60s, you know, his successors pursued kind of like what we call guns and butter, kind of like a warfare welfare state. We financed this huge war in Vietnam via credit, which was unusual for an American war, and also these like great society programs. So by the end of the 60s, the rest of the world was like, I don't know if America can be trusted to like hold the peg. Like, we think the dollar might devalue. We want our gold back. Like, here, take your dollars. We want our gold, you know? And Nixon was able to hold them off for long enough, but in the summer of 71, the other countries just had it. And the French actually sent a battleship to New York City to reclaim their gold. Britain started to make similar motions. And a couple days later, in September of 71, Nixon closed the gold window. So this meant that like we would no longer redeem dollars for gold anywhere, internationally or domestically, that had been cut off decades before, you know, by FDR. So, you know, essentially, the world changed. We went on to the fiat system instead of the gold standard, or you know, the sort of halfway gold standard of the Bretton Woods era. That ended, and the dollar did devalue. They were right. Within 18 months, the dollar depreciated 20% against other major currencies. Okay. So Nixon and Kissinger were like trying to figure out what to do. They're like, how do we salvage the value of the dollar? What can we do? And they looked around and they saw like one particular set of countries that had this like massive amount of new money. And that was the Arab states, highlighted by Saudi Arabia. And, you know, they basically had raised the price of oil very high in dollar terms. And they had kind of embargoed the United States because of our involvement in supporting Israel during the Yom Kippur War. So we were kind of at loggerheads here, but the Nixon administration basically reached out to the Saudis and said, let's do a deal. Saudis were like, all right, I'll listen. And basically this is where the petrodollar system was born. So the idea was that like all the oil that the Saudis, as the swing state of all the OPEC nations and OPEC as a whole would sell, would only be denominated in dollars. So you had to have dollars to buy oil from them, and they controlled like 80% of the world's oil or something like that at the time. Okay, so Nixon and Kissinger knew that that would be just this like massive, that would cause a massive demand for dollars, right? The other half of it was that like these countries, because they'd raised the price of oil from like $2 to 10 or something like that, they had a lot of income. And they couldn't spend it in their own countries. So they actually, Nixon and Kissinger actually hired a bond salesman named William Simon to be the Treasury Secretary. And he sold bonds. So as part of this deal, not only did the Saudis have to denominate the sale of their oil in dollars, and the rest of OPEC followed, but with the proceeds, they would buy US debt. They would buy bonds. So like this is called petrodollar recycling. And it really like boosted the dollar's value. It created dominance over the energy markets for the dollar, put a lot of pressure on the Soviet Union. I mean, it was brilliant geostrategic kind of strike, brilliant. And I don't think they even knew how important it would be. And then in return for doing that, like we would protect the Saudis and sell them a ton of arms. So we basically became like non-market exporter of weapons to the Saudis and the Arab states, and they became non-market buyers of treasuries. Like they got like a special deal. So this is the petrodollar system, and it changed over time in different ways. Like in the 80s, the price of oil declined. So Germany and Japan ended up becoming the biggest buyers of our debt, later China. But at the heart of it remains this alliance with Saudi Arabia, where they would denominate the sale of oil in dollars, and that had this massive impact on like oil derivatives, which are massive. Like every barrel of oil has like some absurd number of derivatives, as well as just general energy markets, and then also just currency markets. Like if you're Malawi and you need to buy oil, like you're gonna have to do it in dollars. So you have to go get dollars. So that creates like not only additional demand for dollars, but like a currency pair between your currency and the dollar, and the network effects were just so strong. So the thing was like a really smart way to just kind of like preserve and amplify American power after leaving the gold standard. So basically we were like kind of backed by oil after we were backed by gold. That was the idea. And over the years, the US fought very hard to protect the system. The biggest threat came in the form of the euro, which is all the European countries getting together in the 90s and creating their own currency, which was very powerful, similar to the dollar in terms of global impact. And the first country to try to sell its oil for dollars, rather for euros instead of dollars, was Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And by 2002, he was selling 5% of the world's oil in euros. You know, hey, 6 months later, we invaded and out with Saddam, and by June the Iraqis were selling oil in dollars again. And look, if you just look at all the real explanations for the Iraq war, they were all nonsense. Like it wasn't about human rights or Iraqi freedom. There were no WMDs. There was no connections to Al-Qaeda. It wasn't about countering Iran. I mean, Saddam was the guy we supported to counter Iran. Like none of it makes any sense. And it wasn't like for the oil itself either, because America didn't import very much oil from the Middle East. We got most of our oil from ourselves, from Canada, from Venezuela, Mexico. So this just to me, like Occam's razor, like makes the most sense, is it was sort of to protect this very important system. But today it's like unraveling, and we can't protect it like we used to. It lasted about 50 years. It'll last a little more, but it's coming undone. And I think that instead of having like, basically people have been saving in dollars or more accurately treasuries, I guess, over the last 30 years, that's been the hardest money in the world or whatever, like what other nation states want to save in, right? Aside from gold, which has been quite, the US kind of very much limited the role of gold, right? Through its policies. If you look at it, that's kind of what we did after World War I up through the 70s, we kind of removed gold from the world economy in a way, like we removed its importance. So other nations are trying to stack that, but at the end of the day, like Bitcoin is a big threat to this system. And aside from an obvious, reliance on fossil fuels and oil and all that stuff, it's supported Saudi Arabia and all these dictators who probably wouldn't be around were it not for the system. And it's caused a lot of like foreign aggressions and wars that America probably didn't want to get into had we not had to protect this. And finally, it's actually caused a pretty damaging set of results for our middle and lower classes in America, because basically we have this thing called the Triffin dilemma, which this economist Triffin published about in the 50s and 60s, where, you know, naturally a country will have like a balance of payments. And if it gets too big, they'll necessarily have to kind of devalue their currency to bring the deficit down, and their exports accordingly will become a little cheaper, more competitive, and will kind of balance the balance of payments gap is the idea. That doesn't happen with the United States. There's this dilemma where regardless of what we do, regardless of how strong or weak our currency is, there's this constant demand for our debt by other nations because it's the reserve asset. So, you know, we keep getting more and more into debt because there's this huge demand for it. So that's why we have this like massive balance of payments issue right now. And what that does is like over time, it basically makes our currency quite strong and we have to export our jobs elsewhere. So we like end up exporting all of our jobs abroad to China, wherever, you know, wherever they went. Essentially, this has led to, you know, a very rough situation for the middle classes. A lot of their jobs went elsewhere. They are in despair. There's like a huge meth pandemic across the nation, stagnated in wages, things like that. So look, it's been, the petrodollar system has been really great if you're like a coastal American in like defense or IT or financial services, like on the coastal elites, it's been great for you, but like people in the middle of the country, not so much. So that's kind of the background of that. And that's, you know, very connected with what we talked about earlier with Isaiah Jackson and his work. Like for a lot of these communities, the petrodollar system hasn't been great. And they felt like, why are we in Iraq? And you know, why are our wages stagnating? And, you know, all those people over there are getting super rich. And Bitcoin's just like a big way out of the system. It just allows anybody access to like this very high performance savings investment, which is very empowering. So that's like the way I would look at that.
Awesome. Thanks for the rundown on that. Yeah, it's crazy how everything's intertwined. Comes back to the money and the gold window closing, you know, in the 70s. And it's really crazy when you start to break into it, and you've broken into it from every different angle. And we definitely appreciate your writings and your continued research on that. I know you have to run, but I've got one quick final question. Sure. To wrap up. If you had a 2-hour dinner with anyone that could be dead or alive, and we're going to assume they know about the internet, and you could explain Bitcoin to them and what it could mean for humanity, who would that be and why?
Oh man, one dinner. I'd probably have a short list and have to figure it out later, but obviously I think Thomas Jefferson would be pretty up there. Guy who read the Declaration of Independence would have to be up there. Martin Luther King would be pretty amazing. Gandhi. Yeah, those would probably be three of my top three top picks right there.
Hard to argue with that list in any way, shape, or form. But Alex, really appreciate your time. Thanks for squeezing me in here today. Tell the listeners where they can find you, and I'll make sure to have links to all your stuff in the show notes.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Gladstein or the work of the Human Rights Foundation at hrf.org. And yeah, thanks for having me on.
Wonderful. Well, have a great one. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening once again to that episode with Alex Gladstein. I know this one was quicker than usual, but Alex packed in quite a bit of great information there in that short time frame. If you haven't already, definitely make sure that you go check out Alex's essays on Bitcoin Magazine, or they're also on Guy Swan's Bitcoin Audible. Each one of them is phenomenal and they have a ton of great information. Now, if you like the show and you enjoy what I'm doing with the pod, I would really appreciate if you like, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. That would definitely help me out in the rankings. You can also find me at E3BTC on all social media and E3BTC.com. I appreciate the continued support, and we'll catch you guys soon. Take us away, bro.